Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy for the Cold War and its legacies, exploring the global impact of this pivotal era. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
Spotted owls are in peril. Can a controversial plan save them? I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday. The spotted owl has been a conservation flashpoint for more than 30 years. Habitat loss is their historic foe. But the most recent threat comes within the owl family tree, the barred owl. A federal plan to save the spotted owl has ruffled some feathers. It involves killing up to 450,000 barred owls.
It is almost assured that we will, in fact, lose the spotted owl if we do not control barred owls.
We'll sink our claws into this plan and learn how we got to this point after the break. Stay with us.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Vaccine advisors to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have recommended narrowing their hepatitis B immunization guidance for newborns. NPR's Ping Wong reports the change rolls back a decades-long policy.
The panel voted to recommend a birth dose of the hepatitis B vaccine only for infants born to women who test positive. Previously, the shot had been recommended to all babies. It's a policy credited with dramatically lowering liver diseases caused by the virus. Pediatrician Cody Meissner voted against the change.
Do no harm is a moral imperative. We are doing harm by changing this wording, and I vote no.
But he and two others opposed to the change were overruled by eight members of the committee who voted yes. Several said they cast their votes to support parents making their own decisions. CDC staff pointed out that the previous policy allowed for this and that the group's responsibility is to make recommendations at the population level. Ping Huang, NPR News.
The streaming giant Netflix is taking over Warner Brothers' film studio and streaming service, HBO Max. Netflix beat out Comcast and Paramount Skydance with a deal that has total enterprise value of $82.7 billion. Under the agreement, Warner Brothers Discovery continues with its plan to spin out its television networks, including CNN and TNT. NPR's David Folkenflik reports a merger is expected to prompt federal and state scrutiny.
Even if the federal government didn't intervene, state attorneys general might well want to scrutinize this on their own on behalf of their residents and constituents who will potentially face higher subscription fees as there are fewer major movie and television streamers like HBO, like Netflix, to draw from. The likelihood is prices could go up.
NPR's David Folkenflik reporting. A grand jury in Virginia has declined to indict New York Attorney General Letitia James, according to two sources familiar with the decision. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports the Justice Department has the option of asking a different grand jury to bring mortgage-related charges.
President Trump has been vocal about his desire to see the Justice Department charge Tish James, one of his most prominent critics. A federal judge threw out a bank fraud case against her after ruling the prosecutor who brought the case had been unlawfully appointed. This week, the DOJ tried again with a different prosecutor in Virginia, but the grand jury appears to have rejected charges, a rare move, but one that's happening more often this year. James says the charges are baseless and it's time for the weaponization of the justice system to stop. Her lawyer says this should be the end of the case. Carrie Johnson, NPR News.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 164 points at 48,015. From Washington, this is NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt in Oakland. The Inspector General for California's massive prison system says a backlog of investigations into staff misconduct has ballooned to 10,000 cases. KQED's Julie Small reports.
The Allegation Investigation Unit is opening cases on staff misconduct faster than it's closing them. A new report finds that's adding an average of 650 cases a month to the backlog. The delays could mean many investigations could not be completed within a one-year statute of limitations, and officers could not be disciplined for misconduct. Prison officials are testing out ways to expedite investigations. I'm Julie Small, KQED News.
Pamela Price is running for district attorney in Alameda County just a year after she was recalled from the position. The progressive prosecutor was overwhelmingly ousted last November amid complaints of high crime and allegations of incompetence and misconduct in her office. Speaking Thursday, Price said she was forced out by a small group of wealthy elites who opposed her progressive policies.
Alameda County wants real justice that does not bend for wealth, status, or political connections. I will be the district attorney who puts people first.
During her tenure, Price launched a division to investigate police misconduct and filed resentencing motions in dozens of death row cases after evidence of prosecutorial bias surfaced. I'm Brian Watt, KQBD News.
Support comes from Postman, offering a platform to assist teams build APIs to help API agents make decisions. Postman.com. And support for NPR comes from Arm, committed to delivering innovative advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm, Arm.com. And support comes from listeners like you who support and donate. And they're very, very important to us here at KQED News. Sunshine for the Bay Area, except in the interior portions of the area, highs mid-50s to low-60s. Mostly cloudy skies for the southern Sacramento Valley. Looks like a dense fog advisory just officially expired at 11 this morning. Highs across the valley today, 50 to 57. 6 minutes after 11 o'clock.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, a new TV show pulls back the curtain on the strange and gigantic animals that walk the tundra and deserts during the Ice Age. Plus, a controversial plan to save the spotted owl is pitting owl lovers against other owl lovers. But first, let's turn to a topic that's sucking all the air out of the room, and I mean electricity and water too, actually. I'm talking, of course, about the huge build-out of data center construction across the country for the AI boom. Hundreds of billions have been spent already, with talks of trillions more. And according to the Times-Picayune, and listen to this, Meta's new data center under construction in Louisiana requires nearly three times the power that New Orleans uses in a year. This has not gone unnoticed. Rising utility rates nationwide have become issues in some recent elections. Casey Crownhart, a senior climate reporter at MIT Technology Review, has been studying the costs and impacts, and she's back here to fill us in. Welcome back to SciFry, Casey.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Can you give us a sense of the scale of this buildup? Because the last resource drain like this that comes to my mind was crypto mining, but this seems even bigger.
Absolutely. I think the money and the electricity that we're seeing talked about, you know, the scale of these numbers is kind of eye-popping. So according to the International Energy Agency, data centers accounted for about, you know, 1.5% of the world's electricity consumption in 2024. And that's set to double by 2030. We're seeing so many data centers get built out. One number that really struck me was in a recent report that there was $580 billion invested globally in AI in 2025 and data centers. That's more than the $540 billion spent on developing the global oil supply. So this year, we spent more on data centers than the oil supply.
Wow. You know, a lot of people may not realize that when they ask a question of ChatGPT or Gemini, that it actually contributes to this. It uses up electricity. We had you on in the summer to talk about some reporting that you did about just how much energy these models use, and you told us the data was dodgy then. Do we have any more clarity on how much energy that's being used?
Yeah, so since we, you know, came up with our own estimates working with leading researchers in this area, a couple of companies have come out with estimates of, you know, how much energy each query or each kind of question you ask to one of its models will use. And it turns out we were kind of in the right region. So Google came out with an estimate that says that, you know, the average query to its Gemini model uses about 0.24 watt hours of electricity. That, you know, and I like to put things in microwave seconds. So that's about the same as a second in the microwave. ChatGPT, OpenAI came out with its own estimate. It's kind of in the same range, about 0.34 watt hours. So basically the individual queries or kind of individual questions you're asking, it's a not insignificant amount of energy, yeah, but it's kind of small.
But they don't say the total energy used for all of its AI activities, right?
Exactly. And so that's something that I've been talking about a lot this year, is that it's great that we're starting to get these kind of estimates of individual queries, but that doesn't really give us the full picture. You know, we're seeing billions and billions of people and queries every day. And so this is all adding up to a lot.
Now, we've been talking about electricity, but we know these data centers use a lot of water to cool those chips. And most of them are built in pretty dry areas like Arizona and Nevada. Why is that?
Part of the reason is that in a lot of cases, these companies are looking for places that are, you know, have plentiful land, cheap energy. That's what they're really looking for when they're trying to find a place to build a data center. So like you said, you know, a good amount of this activity is happening in Nevada, Arizona, Texas. Two-thirds of new data centers that are in development since 2022 are in these kind of water-stressed areas.
Yeah, and how much of this is drinking water here? What, you know, and what happens to that water after it's used for cooling the servers?
It depends on what the water is being used for. So when we're talking about water consumption for AI, a lot of it is actually what's called indirect use. So the water that's used at the power plants that are actually running the data centers, you know, some estimates say that over 60% of the water consumed when we're talking about AI is from power plants. So it kind of depends on what segment of this you're talking about. You know, some power plants are able to use treated water or something. But when it comes to the actual data centers and the water that they're using to keep their machines cool, a lot of them do need to use drinking quality water, because when they're, you know, doing this evaporative cooling, they want to avoid like clogging their pipes, bacterial growth. It's, you know, very sensitive equipment.
Can you give us an idea of how much water we're talking about here?
It's kind of moderate when you look at it overall. So one report found that data centers use about 0.3% of the nation's total water use. But again, that's set to double between 2023 and 2030. You know, it's kind of small when you look at the big picture, but it will very much affect local grids. You know, in some cases, a single data center can use more water than an entire county's homes do.
Are the big companies, the big chip companies that are using the water, are they sensitive to this and looking for more efficient ways?
Absolutely. There's a lot of research and a lot of really interesting work being done in cooling, and there are different ways to cool data centers that use less water. So today, a lot of data centers are cooled with what's called evaporative cooling. And so basically, you know, just you let the water evaporate and that cools down the equipment. That obviously, you lose a lot of the water that you're kind of pulling out of the resources. So there are other techniques. So something like direct liquid cooling, where, you know, you have a coolant kind of circulating directly through the servers. There's also immersion cooling, where servers are submerged in some sort of fluid to help keep them cool. So there's a lot of interesting alternatives. Some of them, at least right now, tend to have some sort of downside. So they're either more expensive. In some cases, they're also more electricity intensive. So, you know, might use as much as 10% more energy as compared to evaporative cooling. So it's kind of a trade-off. But we are seeing, you know, a lot of companies are sensitive to this, especially as we've seen this public outcry.
I can understand that, because doesn't Microsoft use something like 8 million gallons of water a year in their chips?
It's absolutely bonkers. And another aspect that we haven't really talked about, and this is kind of a niche part of this, is you also need very, very high purity water to actually make the chips. And so again, when we're talking about the whole picture of water use by AI, it's not just water being used to cool power plants, water being used to cool data centers. There's also an element of this, of just making the chips, and that can be up to 10% of the total water use.
Let's get into some of the politics of this, because the recent governors-elect for New Jersey and Virginia both campaigned on lowering utility rates. Now, Virginia has the largest concentration of data centers in the world. So what kind of pressures are states facing as more tech companies are trying to build these?
Yeah, it's been a really interesting conversation, especially around the elections this year. I'm based in New Jersey, and so I saw so many commercials, you know, one side or the other saying, oh, they're going to raise your electricity rates. So I think that, you know, as people continue to see prices go up across the board. I think there's, you know, even more sensitivity to this. And so people are saying, well, you're coming in and raising my electricity rates. And so we're seeing a lot of projects block. One recent report from Data Center Watch found that from just March to June, about $93 billion worth of projects were either delayed or canceled because of community pushback.
What happened to all those climate pledges that Google and Microsoft and others were promising a few years back?
Yeah, this is a great question. So some tech companies, it's kind of hard to paint with a broad brush, but some tech companies have kind of stopped reporting as much or kind of backed off. Google does say that they're still on track for their 2030 net zero energy goals.
Right.
But I think that, again, in this AI build out, they're really chasing a moving target. We're seeing as they need so much electricity, even the companies that are doing really great work in procuring a lot of wind and solar, helping support new advanced clean energy technologies. It's just a huge challenge when they're seeing their energy demand increase off the charts.
Yeah, because they were talking about using renewables for this, or possibly even nuclear. Microsoft bought out all that usage on Three Mile Island. So we'll have to see how that works out.
Absolutely. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how these kind of longer term plays end up working out, especially like you said, that this nuclear build out, the efforts to reopen shuttered plants, such a long term play. Like it takes years even just to reopen a nuclear plant.
Yeah.
And, you can build a data center much more quickly than that. And so I think that's kind of one of the fundamental challenges here is that AI has become part of the daily lives of people so quickly. And so companies are racing to keep up with that and kind of continue this growth curve. And building energy, our energy system is complicated. It takes a while to build. And so that's kind of one of the fundamental challenges that I've been thinking about a lot this year.
And that's the existential challenge to me. I mean, that you say how much people are going to depend and are depending on AI. Are we going to reach a trade-off we reached on other energy consuming lifestyles that we have, like fossil fuels usage, about whether we want to trade water and climate change for this new lifestyle we can't live without?
And I think one thing that I've been thinking about a lot this year is, when we're talking about, ChatGPT uses this much energy or water, whatever model you want to talk about, you should just not use it. You should just avoid it. And I think one kind of message I have for people is, sure, I don't want to say that, make as many generative videos as you want. But increasingly, it's not really a personal choice. This is part of our digital infrastructure. This is, you're getting AI suggestions based on your Google searches. You're, getting ads served to you that maybe were generated using AI.
Right.
And so I think that this is overall a systems conversation that we need to be having rather than, talking about personal choices and personal use.
Good point, Casey. You always bring good stuff to us. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Casey Crownhart, Senior Climate Reporter for the MIT Technology Review. We have to take a break, and when we come back, a new documentary explores what it took for animals to survive during the Ice Age.
Woolly mammoths actually lacked specific genes that are related to feeling cold. They actually had, they were genetically adapted for being okay in the cold.
Stay with us. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Support for KQED comes from the International School of San Francisco, a bilingual multicultural community where students PK2 through grade 12 learn to navigate the world with confidence, empathy, and joy. More at internationalsf.org. And Peninsula Lively Arts presenting Hip Hop Nutcracker, a spin on a holiday favorite with beloved music and fresh moves. December 20th at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. at the San Mateo Performing Arts Center. Details at peninsulalivelyarts.org.
I'm Peter Sagal. This week, the White House insulted Sabrina Carpenter and Franklin the Turtle, but despite our best efforts, not us. Join us for the apparently insufficiently provocative news quiz from NPR.
The quizzing and the laughs begin tomorrow morning at 11. Also hear the program, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Tomorrow evening at 6 and or Sunday morning at 10. Here on KQED News. Michael stayed in for Sandy Althaus. Science Friday time is 11:20.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Koalas with the body of a lion. Elephants the size of your dog. Gigantic 8-foot-tall sloths. No, these aren't creatures found in a new novel. They walked our planet a million years ago, during the Ice Age. And that's the focus of the new season of Apple's Prehistoric Planet series, which uses the latest paleontology research and photoreal CGI to recreate ancient creatures from the past. So far, it's focused on dinosaurs, but now it's taking that same approach to the fantastical and strange-looking animals that walked the tundra and enormous deserts of the Ice Age. Here to thaw out the new research featured in the show are two of its scientific consultants, Dr. Darren Naish, paleontologist and author in Southampton, UK, and Dr. Emily Lindsay, associate curator at the La Brea Tar Pits and Museum in Los Angeles, one of my favorite places. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks. Good to talk to you again.
Darren, we had you on the show a couple of years ago to talk about the science in the first season of this show, which, as I said before, focused on dinosaurs. What were you excited about with this season going into the Ice Age? What did you want to do differently?
That's a great question and a hard one to answer. As a fan of animals in general, you know, when I knew that we were going to be making an Ice Age series, even the Ice Age animals that are the most household names of these creatures that you can think of, you know, woolly mammoths. Who hasn't heard of a woolly mammoth? That's not an unfamiliar animal. You know, most of us have kind of grown up with exposure to, you know, the fact that there were such animals. But that doesn't kind of, you know, mean that there aren't amazing things to learn about it. Like, what does it actually look like in life and how does it behave? So I knew that even building, you know, the super familiar animals, the woolly mammoth, various of the species of saber-toothed cats, you know, just building those familiar animals was going to be a formidable challenge. It was going to be really great fun. We were going to learn a lot from it. And because mammoths are elephants, because saber-toothed cats are cats, these animals actually present a real special challenge in terms of bringing them to life, something that, you know, obviously we had to work incredibly closely with the CG animators at Framestore, because the familiarity of those animals in fact makes them even harder to reconstruct accurately and realistically than animals that are actually pretty remote to us today. You know, if you're talking about a tyrannosaur, like, very few people today have got a real good idea of how a tyrannosaur might look as a living animal. But if it's a cat, you get that slightly wrong and immediately it just doesn't pass the sniff test.
Right.
So building those animals, I knew that was going to be tremendous, a challenge and fun. And then there's all these obscure creatures, these less familiar, very extinct weirdos relative to the sort of northern hemisphere perspective animals, like the giant marsupials from Australia, various extinct animals from tropical Africa and South America. You know, various weird, obscure sloths, various giant marsupials, giant short-faced kangaroos. Could not wait to get to grips with those, because experts have competing ideas on what they look like, how they moved, how they behaved, how we would actually bring that together and build them. I knew that would be a fun challenge. And the results speak for themselves. I'm super happy with how all our animals look.
Emily, do you find evidence in the La Brea tar pits of ancient animals?
Oh, yes, we have thousands upon thousands of animals from the Ice Age that are preserved in the tar pits here in Los Angeles. Interestingly, Los Angeles was actually a little bit cooler and a little wetter than it is today. So it was really a lush kind of savanna ecosystem supporting, you know, multiple species of giant ground sloths. We have seven species of cats here, all the way from the American lion, which is the largest cat that ever lived, multiple species of saber-toothed cats. We have famously direwolves, which are our most common large mammal we find preserved here, mammoths and mastodons, camels and horses and bison. It was an incredibly rich ecosystem of Ice Age LA. But as Darren mentioned, we also have hundreds of species of birds and reptiles and amphibians and mammals that are still alive today, and many of which still live here in the LA Basin.
Okay, so the season opens with a bang, with a woolly mammoth giving birth to a baby in a brutal snowstorm. What did it take to survive as an animal during this time?
One of the key things about the Ice Age world, so the Ice Age is properly known as the Pleistocene, it's about a 2 million year long section of geological time, is famously we are talking about a time when the far north and the far south of our planet is colder than it is today. There are much larger ice sheets, obviously colder temperatures, but you are still talking about a world that does have tropical and subtropical and temperate zones as well. And a key thing that we cover in the series is that with all of this vast amount of water locked up in ice, it meant less kind of atmospheric water across the whole of the planet, which means, you know, lower sea levels and a far drier atmosphere. So things like savannas and deserts were larger during the Ice Age than they are today. So yes, you've got these animals that are adapted for extreme cold, and in multiple different lineages, in particular of big mammals in particular, you saw, you know, animals with extra layers of fat and thick woolly coats and so on. Among groups that today we associate with the tropics, you know, mammoths are not a separate group of animals from elephants. They are a kind of elephant. So, you know, you've got cold adapted elephants. Likewise for big cats, cold adapted, you know, deer and bear and so on. But then in the tropics, you've got many animals that are more adapted for dry climates. So animals with like unusual noses because they are doing what they can to conserve water. And the final thing I have to add, an important point about Ice Age animals, is the Ice Age is so recent. It ended about 11,700 years ago. That's really recent. Everything alive today, with a handful of exceptions, a handful of, you know, very recently evolved animals, weird salamanders and such, everything alive today was alive in the Ice Age, including us. So you've still got to imagine that everything alive today is also present in Ice Age times.
I've also heard that the VFX team referenced cave paintings to get the fur right on the animals. Is that correct?
That's basically right. So we are Ice Age animals. We saw a lot of these animals when we were alive, and people of the Ice Age, some of whom were incredibly skilled and experienced artists, illustrated a lot of these animals when they were alive. And in some cases, they provided us with information that we otherwise wouldn't know. So the main thing that they gave us is patterns of pigmentation. So on some animals, there's various extinct deer and cats, mammoths and rhinos also, where the cave artists showed precise distributions of spots and stripes, gave us some idea which parts of animals were dark, which were light, what fur length was like. And even there's even some clues to posture, you know, like when does a woolly rhino have its tail in the air, stuff like that. So yes, we took account of all of that and built it into our models as well.
Darren, you know, we obviously think of the ice and snow during the Ice Age. That's, we call it the Ice Age. But the show spends a lot of time in deserts, in tropical regions. What were those like?
Yeah, so the fact that the Ice Age goes from round about 2.6 million years ago until round about 11,700 years ago, that's enough time for a lot of change to happen. We also know, we've known for centuries that this span of time that we term the Ice Age actually consists of multiple very cold spells and then very warm spells. And during the interglacials, the warm spells, you've got to imagine that somewhere today that we consider fairly, you know, cool and temperate might actually have been a little bit, you know, warmer, drier. I'm obviously in southern England, and during some of the interglacials, there were animals here that today we think of as animals of tropical Asia, the Middle East, you know, parts of Africa. So there were giant elephants here, and there were hippos, and there were lions. There were lions of a kind of tropical sort here in England. So from our perspective today, a completely different world. So it's a super interesting world, a really more diverse world. And the key take-home point for me about the Ice Age is, in a way, the diversity of animal life in the Ice Age is kind of what our planet's meant to be like. When we think of giant animals today, if you're in North America, you're thinking of, you've got moose and you've got, you know, two big bear species, a couple of other big deer and whatnot, and bison, obviously. But alongside those, you know, there should be armadillos the size of small cars, sloths bigger than the biggest bear. There should be several species of elephant living wild in North America. And I can say similar things, you know, everywhere in the world, except Antarctica. All the major land masses had this amazing assortment of animals that are no longer with us at all. So we've got a very impoverished view of megafaunal diversity. Megafauna is anything above about 40 kilos.
That raises the question, if you found the same species on completely different continents, how did that happen?
Yeah. So many animals that today we associate with a specific region in the Ice Age were able to spread widely around the world. The lion's a great example. You know, we mostly think of lions as an African animal. There were also lions in the, you know, in the Middle East. But in the Ice Age, there were lions throughout the whole of Asia, throughout the whole of Europe, throughout North America, and some lions probably got into South America as well. This is partly due to the appearance of land bridges. So if sea level is going up and down, according to how much water is locked up in ice, lower sea levels mean that areas of land that today are separated by sea were connected during the Ice Age. So the most familiar example is Beringia, which is the area that contacts Alaska with Siberia. If that's dry land, animals can obviously pass relatively freely between North America and Asia.
Hmm.
Yeah, I want to add to that, actually, to both of Darren's points. So I completely agree with the point that we have an impoverished view of an understanding of megafaunal diversity from the present day. You know, 50 plus million years, the normal state for planet Earth has been to have large animals, chiefly mammals, on all the ice-free continents on Earth. And it's only very, very recently in geologic time that that hasn't been the case. And these migrations, you know, I mean, they started happening millions of years ago. So a lot of species that we actually associate with other places, maybe Africa or Asia or South America, actually started out in North America. So camels would be one of the key examples here. You know, in North America, we tend to think of camels as very exotic animals, but they actually evolved here in North America. And then,
really?
Yes. And then, you know, 10 or 15 million years ago, they crossed a land bridge into Eurasia and became modern camels. 3 million years ago, the Isthmus of Panama formed. They crossed down into South America and became llamas. And then they went extinct here in North America at the end of the Ice Age. And so what you see happening during the extinction event at the end of the Ice Age that wiped out more than two-thirds of the large mammals on Earth is a real range contraction of species that, as Darren mentioned, used to be really widely distributed. Lions, camels, horses, elephants. And now they're only associated usually with, you know, one continent mm-hmm. or one particular geographic region.
This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. We're talking about how the new Apple TV Prehistoric Planet season brought Ice Age animals back to life. Let me ask you a bit about that, because I know you study how ecosystems collapse. How did the Ice Age end?
Well, so that's something that scientists have been debating for more than 70 years now, and it's still a point of contention. But I think, you know, if you take a zoomed out view of it, the story of the last 50,000 years or so is the story of one megafaunal species, Homo sapiens, sort of systematically replacing most other large mammal species on Earth. So humans were definitely a key player in this extinction event on a sort of broad brush scale. Now, I think the question is, like, how did we do it, right? And I think the show does a good job of communicating the stresses that animal populations experienced due to these very significant climate changes that were happening. And so how did sort of climate and environmental change intersect with sort of growing human population and technology and resource consumption to cause this sort of ecosystem global tipping point where we go from, you know, the age of mammals to really the age of humans?
Are you saying that we hunted these large animals out of existence?
I think it's more complicated than that. You know, when scientists talk about humans being responsible for the extinction, they're usually thinking about hunting, but I don't think that Homo sapiens hunted down, you know, every species, dozens and dozens of mm-hmm. species went extinct at the end of the Ice Age. We do have good evidence of humans hunting in some cases on large scale, particular species, different types of elephant species, right? Mammoths. We know they hunted horses and camels. There are other species that we have absolutely zero evidence of humans hunting. Wow. So I think there's a combination of hunting and other impacts. And something that we discovered here based on research at the La Brea Tar Pits that we conducted a couple of years ago is that at least in this region, there's a particular tool that humans were able to use to completely transform the ecosystem, and that was fire.
Hmm.
And we discovered that right at the point when large animals stop getting trapped at the La Brea Tar Pits, there is this order of magnitude increase in fire on the landscape, and those fires were very likely ignited by humans.
So where are we in our general understanding of the Ice Age now? You mentioned new research that you've discovered at La Brea Tar Pits, but in general, compared to past decades, what do we know more now than we knew years ago?
In many ways, this is the golden age of Ice Age studies for a bunch of reasons. It was the perfect time to make a TV series devoted to these animals and their world because there's so much amazing and new science that's being done on them. So, for example, DNA studies, you know, there's this new information that's helping us work out how these animals are related to one another and even aspects of their life appearance, some of their adaptations to the cold we've learned about thanks to, you know, recent genetic discoveries. We know, for example, that woolly mammoths actually lacked specific genes that are related to feeling cold. And they actually had, like, they were genetically adapted for being okay in the cold. And slightly sad subject, but global warming that we are causing is resulting in the increasing discovery of Ice Age animals in Siberian and Alaskan permafrost. So we are finding year on year more permafrost bodies, you know, nearly complete, beautifully preserved Ice Age animals that give us, you know, like, so much information on what the animals actually look like. This is a great time to make a TV series about these incredible animals.
Well, I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us today. Fascinating stuff. Dr. Darren Naish, paleontologist and author, and Dr. Emily Lindsay, associate curator and excavation site director at the La Brea Tar Pits and Museum. You can catch the new season of Prehistoric Planet on Apple TV. We have to take a break, and when we come back, a controversial plan to save the spotted owl is pitting owl lovers against other owl lovers. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Science Friday is supported by MathWorks, created as a MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Science Friday is also supported by BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands. With therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. And by Progressive Insurance. Progressive's rate comparison tool can be used to find a competitive rate on car insurance for coverage on the road. Options to fit most any budget, more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Science Friday is produced by the Science Friday Initiative, sciencefriday.com.
This week on Science Friday, microbes dominate life on Earth, but they're basically absent from conservation plans. A group of scientists is on a quest to change that.
The diversity and their adaptability is just so mind-blowingly awesome that it makes me excited to explore that world and then leverage it to make sure the planet stays safe.
That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
And that, among other stories, ahead in the noon hour of the program here on KQED News. Michael stayed in for Sandy Althaus. Support for KQED comes from Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity. Imagine that. KQED's Bay Curious podcast is sponsored by Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, and it features fun trivia questions at the end of each episode. So listen to test your Bay Area knowledge and enter to win cool prizes at kqed.org/baycurious. This week in KQED Science, meteor showers, a massive moon, and even a chance to see Jupiter at its most striking. We look ahead to this winter's astronomical events on KQED Science. Find it at kqed.org/science. Becoming sunny for this Friday for the Bay Area. Bay Area highs today mid-50s to low 60s. Mostly cloudy for the southern Sacramento Valley. Highs of 50 to 57.
This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. Before we get started, if you're doing holiday shopping for the young science lovers in your life, we have a guide for this year's best science books for kids on our website, sciencefriday.com/books. There are suggestions about butterflies and black holes and dinosaurs and hurricanes and more. Check it out at sciencefriday.com/books. Now onto the show. We're looking at a new kind of shocking proposal to save spotted owls. These are the cute, charismatic birds that live in old-growth forests in the West and are threatened by habitat loss and logging. People have been arguing about these birds for over 30 years. They're a conservation poster child. So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has proposed a new strategy to save them, and it's kind of startling.
The barred owl management strategy proposes killing 450,000 barred owls over the next 30 years across 24 million acres. Which
yes, you heard that right. Saving spotted owls by killing as many as 450,000 barred owls. The proposed strategy is, as you would guess, controversial and has created some strange nest fellows. Loggers and many conservationists are in favor, while some lawmakers and animal welfare groups are opposed. It's been challenged in court, and its fate is uncertain, but people are talking about it. So we wanted to know what one of the world's top spotted owl experts thinks of this approach. So we called up applied ecologist Rocky Gutierrez, professor emeritus at University of Minnesota. He's been studying spotted owls for decades. Hey, Rocky, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me, Flora.
This is your area of expertise. I mean, you've studied spotted owls for decades. Do you think this plan is a good idea?
It is the only option that we have if we want to ensure the persistence of the spotted owl. But it's far more than the spotted owl. What people don't realize is that the entire ecosystem function and the number of species that this barred owl is affecting is enormous. There was just a paper that was published last week that showed 29 species that are threatened, endangered, or species of conservation concern are being impacted by the barred owl.
Such as, give me some examples.
Examples are red-legged frogs, endangered salamanders, all the small owls that coexist with the spotted owl, like the flammulated owl, the screech owls, pygmy owls, and so forth.
What is it about the barred owl? Why are they such a problem?
Well, the barred owl is not native to Western North America. It invaded from the East Coast, we think, as a result of changes that humans made to the Midwestern United States that allowed them to move across the country and invade the forest of the Pacific Northwest. And since then, as many invaders do, once they get into an area in which there's no known competition, the prey have not adapted to them, and so they flourish.
I mean, how urgent is this? If we don't do something, will spotted owls go extinct? And what's the timeline that we have for them?
Well, we don't know the exact timeline, but it is almost assured that we will, in fact, lose the spotted owl if we do not control barred owls.
I'm curious for your thoughts on this. I think this is, it's emotional for people. Like, it's really hard to imagine killing hundreds of thousands of owls, that being sort of the best idea we have. You know, you are wearing an owl sweater right now. You've dedicated your life to owls. Do you have complicated feelings about this?
Of course I do. I think every single biologist that's involved with this is not happy that this is the only viable alternative, that realistically it is the only viable alternative. People love owls, and at least in this country they do, and they elicit a strong emotive response from people. Therefore, there's a strong emotional reaction, as you said, to this choice to kill these owls. However, even in your introduction, one of the premises that's misleading that is commonly used by opponents of this act is that the 450,000 barred owls are going to be killed. And that's just not true. What the Fish and Wildlife Service did in creating a strategy is to create a series of alternatives, the worst case of which would be 450,000 owls. However, that will never be achieved because their preferred strategy will result in something like 5,000 owls a year over 30 years, which is about 150,000 owls. So it's really quite different when you actually root down into their plan and determine what actually that they wish to happen and what is potentially possible.
The 450,000 is the cap, but they actually are aiming for fewer, many fewer.
Yes, but the important point is that barred owls will persist under any alternative of this strategy. So they're not trying to cause the barred owl to go extinct or disappear from the Pacific Northwest, because that's probably impossible at this point in time.
Because there are just so many.
Yes, because there's so many. Except, however, they can keep them out of certain areas. For example, out of Marin County, where there's isolated habitat of spotted owls, and it'll be easy to keep them out of Marin County. And you notice I use the word easy because scientists have proven that it is exceptionally easy when the density of barred owls is low to keep them under control and having minimal impact on spotted owls.
I mean, do we have a sense of what would be impactful for spotted owls? Like, you know, we're talking about these huge numbers, but if you got rid of barred owls in a few key places, or you were, you know, calling populations by many fewer, would that have an impact on the owls, on the spotted owls?
Well, of course, any removal of the barred owls is going to have some impact. The problem that people have recognized, scientists have recognized, is that the density in certain areas is so high that they invade quickly from the surrounding area. This is why they want to have specially designated areas where all the barred owls are removed, so that the spotted owls in certain areas are protected from colonization by locally surrounding barred owls. And when you do that, you can, in fact, well, we think, you can maintain these not only spotted owl populations, but other populations of small owls and other species that are impacted.
That brings up another question, which is this barred owl plan the best way to save spotted owls, or is it just the way that we can imagine doing it because actually, you know, conserving forests is not going to happen?
Yeah, well, one of the things about this plan is that there are various alternatives considered, and they are based on a huge amount of information that have been gathered over four decades on the spotted owl. So we know that there virtually is no viable alternative. Animal welfare groups and others will say, well, you just need to protect the habitat, stop logging. But that's not the answer. It doesn't make any difference how much habitat you protect. It will not prevent the barred owl from invading those habitats, because they use all the habitats that spotted owls use, and they use other habitats that spotted owls don't use. So there is really no alternative. And this is not a conclusion that was derived from haphazard information or short-term information. We probably have more information on the requirements of spotted owls than virtually any other endangered species in the world. So this is a plan that's based on really the only viable alternative that we can perceive as scientists.
Wow. I mean, you know, we know that culling wild animals isn't new. We do this with deer. We do this with coyotes. We also know that there can be, you know, unintended consequences of these kind of management plans. How do you think about that piece of it? The sort of like ecosystem meddling piece?
Yeah, that's sort of interesting. And of course, this is one of the tasks of animal welfare groups, is that they accuse scientists, or the Fish and Wildlife Service for that matter, of playing God. But humans have been manipulating their environment since the dawn of humanity, or at least they've been trying to. And this is no different. In the case of the barred owl and other species in modern society, we control all kinds of things. We control cormorants because they impact fisheries and fishing. We control brown-headed cowbirds because they impact endangered Kirtland's warblers, and the list goes on and on and on. So this is nothing new. It's just that the idea of an owl is so close to the interests of people, including all of us who study owls, that it's really, it strikes a strong emotional response from us.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of a different beast because people love owls.
Right.
How did you find your way to spotted owls in the first place, you know, decades ago?
Well, when I was teaching at a university back east, when I first started my career, I taught a class in Principles of Wildlife Management, and I read a paper by a colleague of mine, Eric Forsman, who talked about the relationship between spotted owls and old-growth forests and the rapid loss of old-growth forests leading to the decline of spotted owls. So when I moved back west to work at another university, Humboldt State, my very first graduate student approached me with a proposition of working on spotted owls. And he said, "What do you think, Rocky?" And I said, "Well, I think the spotted owl could be a big deal someday." This was in 1980.
Wow.
So I had the inclination because of reading that paper by Eric and talking to my students about, you know, the problem with exploitation of resources and the need for exploiting resources and our ability to try to maintain wildlife populations. And, you know, over 40 years later, I'm still studying spotted owls and other owls.
Wow. So it seems like you saw that they would become a flashpoint.
Yeah, I predicted that because it seemed pretty obvious that if you have a finite resource, which was the old growth forest, and a species that presumably depended on old growth forest, that if you lost the old growth forest, you would lose them.
This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. If you're just joining me, I'm talking about spotted owls in the Pacific Northwest with owl ecologist Rocky Gutierrez. I can't let you go. You cannot leave Science Friday without telling us some amazing owl facts because they are so charismatic and interesting. Just tell me a little bit about the spotted owl and, you know, why you love them.
Well, all owls are interesting, and they have been of interest to humans for 40,000 years since they first started drawing pictures of critters on cave walls. And I think they're of interest to people and to me in general because they do something that we cannot do. And that is they can see in very limited light conditions at night. They have a mysterious lifestyle because of their mostly nocturnal behavior. Some are diurnal, but most are nocturnal. And so they conjure up these really emotive conditions in our soul that makes at least me want to study them, to see them, even to go out sometimes at night just listening for them hooting in the distance, not to disturb them, but just to listen to them. Because we know that something is out there in the dark doing something that we can't do. And I think that's one of the real fun things about owls, why I think they attract so many people and have such interest in them, because they can do this that we can't do.
They have a superpower, yeah. Or at least a power we don't have.
Yeah.
Last one. You're wearing an owl sweater today.
Yes.
I know your wife knits you owl sweaters. Do you have a spotted owl sweater?
I do have a spotted owl sweater. It was the very first one she made for me many years ago, and it's still my favorite. But today I'm wearing a long-whiskered owlet sweater, which is a diminutive, a little tiny owl that lives in the high Andes of Peru in a cloud forest, in a tiny elfin cloud forest. And they sound like insects when they call. Strange little things.
Before we let you go, will you do a spotted owl call for us?
Sure. Yeah. So a spotted owl call is usually a series of four note hoots. You go, oh, 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 oh. So it's one, one, two, one. And that's sort of the male, and the females have a higher pitch voice, and they kind of sound like this. But they make all kinds of other sounds, and when they get really agitated, they go.
That's Dr. Rocky Gutierrez impersonating a spotted owl. He's an owl ecologist and professor emeritus at the University of Minnesota. Rocky, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
And you can see a picture of Rocky's owl sweaters at sciencefriday.com/spotted owl. Before we wrap up, some listener mail. We did a trivia segment on the show recently and asked for your best fun facts. And of course, Science Friday listeners are going to deliver on that ask. So here's one of our favorites.
Hi, my name is Matt from Minneapolis, and the science fact I'd like to share is that your bones are replaced every 10 years. So every 10 years, you've got a brand new skeleton.
Thank you, Matt. And to warm up your skeleton as winter bears down on us, we're working on a show about volcanoes, and we are looking for your burning questions. What sets your mind ablaze about lava? What fires you up about eruptions? What do you want to know about mountains that spew fire? Call us 877-4SciFry. That's 877-4SciFry. Thank you for listening. I'm Flora Lichtman.
Science Friday is supported by Progressive Insurance, presenting Progressive's Name Your Price tool, which shows customers coverage options that fit their needs. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Support for Science Friday also comes from Seed.com. Seed's DS01 is a 24-strain 2-in-1 probiotic and prebiotic engineered to survive digestion, support healthy regularity, and promote whole body health. Learn more at seed.com/public. And from StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, StoryWorth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at StoryWorth.com. Science Friday is produced by the Science Friday Initiative, ScienceFriday.com.
From foot-chewing otters to Bay Bridge invading bunnies, Bay Area wildlife has been doing the absolute most this year. I'm Ray Alexandra from KQED's Arts and Culture Desk, and I spent much of 2025 monitoring the habits of local animals for hijinks, fluffy butts, and middle fingers at humanity. You can find my roundup at kqed.org/arts, where the Arts and Culture Desk also looks back at the year's best in film, music, books, and more.
News updates ahead and another great hour of Science Friday for you at noon. Now traffic time, 11:59, beginning in the South Bay. Here's Steve Herrera.
Good afternoon, Michael. It's a slow migration in San Jose. Northbound 101, just before 880, a three-car pileup impacting the right lane. In Berkeley, westbound East Shore Freeway after Ashby Avenue, a two-vehicle fender bender is blocking the third lane for the left. And be alert, Livermore, East 580 before Airway Boulevard, a wooden pallet taking away the right lane. Steve Herrera, 4KQED.
Traffic support comes from Shanyun Performing Arts. Support for KQED comes from PG&E. Wildfires can happen anytime. Now, when a tree or other hazard falls on their power lines, PG&E can turn it off in 1/10 of a second for safety. Learn more at pge.com/EPSS. Mostly sunny Bay Area skies this afternoon. Friday's highs the mid-50s to low.